Welcome to Innovation Hub. I'm Kara Miller. Crime and the fear of crime shapes American life. We ask ourselves, what areas are safe? Who is dangerous? Where should we live? And the issue of crime has driven a national discussion for a long time. My guest today, David Kennedy, has thought a lot about the thorny problem of crime, why so many more young Black men are murdered every year than young white men, and he has spent decades creating new and unorthodox ways of stemming crime, methods that have transformed cities including Pittsburgh, San Francisco, Chicago, and Washington. David Kennedy is the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, a Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America, and he also directs the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. David Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Cara.
So that question of what causes criminal behavior and what you do about it is an old one. And I want to start by playing a clip from President Ronald Reagan launching a new crime initiative in 1982. And he argues here, as you'll see, that social programs don't have much place in helping to stem crime.
This rise in crime, this growth of a hardened criminal class, has partly been the result of misplaced government priorities and a misguided social philosophy. At the root of this philosophy lies utopian presumptions about human nature that see man as primarily a creature of his material environment. By changing this environment through expensive social programs, this philosophy holds that government can permanently change man and usher in an era of prosperity and virtue. In much the same way, individual wrongdoing is seen as the result of poor socioeconomic conditions or an underprivileged background. This philosophy suggests, in short, that there is crime or wrongdoing in society, not the individual, is to blame.
David Kennedy, how do you view President Reagan's argument?
You know, Reagan won that argument for a long time, and there are something like 1.5 million more people in prison than when he made that speech across the country than there were at the time. We are enforcing the law in the kind of neighborhoods that I work in, which are mostly Black neighborhoods, to the point that if you are born a Black man in the country today, you stand a 1 in 3 chance of going to prison during your lifetime. We are enforcing the law at an extraordinary level, and these are still places that have much the same kind of problems with crime and violence that Reagan addressed. So that hasn't worked. Neither has the more liberal prescription of lots of programs and that whole kind of root cause menu. Neither one of those things works against the most intractable issues in our most troubled neighborhoods.
Let me give some numbers to what you're talking about there. You say in the book, and feel free to update this if this has changed, but that the national homicide rate for victims is about 5 victims per 100,000. But in 2005, for Black men 18 to 24, 102 people versus 5 died per 100,000 victims of homicide. I mean, you have another quote in the book where somebody says, we don't live in a nation. We live in neighborhoods.
That's exactly right. And the colleague who said that very pithy thing is a professor at the Rochester Institute of Technology in upstate New York, named John Clofus. And John and I have worked together in Rochester, New York. John continues to work in Rochester. And he's done analysis that says, if you are an 18 or a 19-year-old Black man in the most dangerous neighborhoods in Rochester, your risk of homicide victimization is better than 1 in 200 every single year. It's shocking. 1 in 200 young Black men are being killed in those communities every single year.
Are you frustrated that this does not really seem to be part of the presidential campaign in which we now find ourselves enmeshed? I mean, I never hear people on the stump talking about this.
That's right. And that is true, you will find, only at the national level. So I watch for this stuff like a hawk, and my impression is the same as yours. I haven't heard a word about this so far during the campaign season. I will tell you that is emphatically not true at the state and local level. Governors, mayors, city managers, local elected officials, local residents are desperate about this, but the federal government has pretty much opted out.
So let's talk a little bit about how you got involved in looking at crime. You didn't, growing up, have a lot of interaction with high crime areas. You were sort of a middle-class white kid growing up, right, in Michigan, and went to Swarthmore. How did it come to be that you were in L.A. in the 1980s during the height of the crack epidemic?
I always have to say I was there in a professional capacity. I've spent 25 years now walking crack markets, basically, and it happened really by accident. I wanted to be a writer. I wanted to do, you know, fancy journalism for The New Yorker or something like that. And I had a simply fantastic job, day job, at the Kennedy School of Government in Harvard, not as an academic, but as somebody who went on assignment to write what the Kennedy School calls teaching cases. Kennedy School is a school of government, and like a lot of professional schools, it uses what academics call the case method, just like business schools do. Whereas a business school case might be about marketing, Kennedy School cases were about public management and public issues and government and that sort of thing. And I fell in with a group of scholars there who were interested in policing, and my world was I just did these things one after another. They came in on the pipeline and they got assigned and we went off and did them and then picked up the next one. Only this turned out to be different because it was the early days of the crack epidemic. A lot of the most interesting stories in policing were around these issues of crack markets and violence. Therefore, I started going to these places. It was, as you've alluded to, my first contact with horrifically dangerous and disorderly and fearful American neighborhoods. They were there. Of course, I had paid no more attention to them than most Americans do. And what I saw was so indescribably appalling that I was simply captured by it.
You say that crack changed everything. There had been drugs before the 1980s, right? Illegal, addictive, highly addictive drugs. How does a drug change a neighborhood into a war zone?
So it was not just crack that changed everything. It was also our response to crack. This was something that it took me a long time to see. So when I first started walking these neighborhoods, what I saw was the guns and the violence and the fear and the street shrines to the dead. And you know, this was the beginning of young men's names being spray painted on walls and sidewalks with RIP next to it. All very common now in certain places across the country, unfortunately. And that was real enough. So more than crack as a drug, what hurt these neighborhoods was crack markets. So addiction and use and the impact that has on individuals and families was serious enough. So crack addiction did an enormous amount of damage, especially through the addiction of women and what that then did to families. That was not nearly as serious as what happened because crack was bought and sold in public. So the country is dealing right now with a new, relatively new methamphetamine epidemic. It's dealing with a very serious prescription drug epidemic. Communities, for the most part, are not being destroyed by either one of those things. And this is not to say what's going on is good. It's not. But crack was sold on street corners. It was sold to strangers from outside the neighborhood who drove in and bought crack and went back to, very often, their white communities. That brought with it, you know, groups of young men with guns who wanted to hold on to their corners. It brought prostitutes who followed both the buyers and the drugs. And communities that had been hurting suddenly found themselves coming apart at the seams. And then on top of that, our main response to this was to arrest everybody in sight. And because these markets were overwhelmingly, almost exclusively concentrated in, again, already troubled, poor, primarily African-American neighborhoods. If you fast forward 10 or 15 years, we have literally in many of them, through our criminal justice policies, created circumstances where all the men have been to prison. They all have arrest records. You catch a case when you're 21 and when you're 30 and are you know, older and calmer and wiser, you can't get your life together. You can't get a job. You can't get bonded. You can't pass a background check. You are done as a mainstream human being. And these are neighborhoods now that are reeling under all of that.
It's this perpetual cycle. We're talking to David Kennedy, the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, A Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. And he also directs the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. And David Kennedy, I wonder, you talk about in these inner city, mostly black neighborhoods, sometimes there being a line of cars, like drive-through, like McDonald's, where white people come in from the suburbs to buy drugs. They don't get out of their cars, and they buy it while they're in their cars, and they go back out. And I wonder how much of the drug problem was fueled by the people within the community and how much of it was fueled by the people who are coming to do the drive-through.
In a very real way, nearly all of the trouble was caused by people from outside. And that is not to say that local folks didn't and don't buy dope in these markets, because they do. But the only reason to have what we call an overt drug market, which can be street corner or crack houses or what have you, but what makes something overt is that a stranger can come in and connect and leave again without knowing anybody. And the only reason to have that kind of market is to serve the outside. If that public market went away, people in the neighborhood still know each other, just like white high school kids know each other in high school and buy and sell drugs sometimes at pretty high levels. But it's invisible, it's discreet, nobody's getting shot. I can't walk into one of those high schools and make a connection. So the drug problem, again, has its own kind of public health issues associated with it. What destroys neighborhoods are these market dynamics, and we outsiders are really to blame for all of that.
So you went into places like, for example, High Point, North Carolina, which had a really bad drug market, as you say, in the center of the city. How do you get a drug market to break up? If you've got the people selling and you've got a community that's maybe supporting it or too scared to say anything, and you've got the addicts who are coming in to get their fix, how do you possibly interrupt that dynamic?
So let me home in very, very sharply on something you just said. And it's the way nearly all of us think about these neighborhoods. So you said profiting from it or too scared to say something.
Right.
And what turns out to be so important is that neither of those things is true. Nearly nobody in the neighborhood is actually making money off dope. And we're now getting into the facts that make it possible actually to do something both different and very, very effective. So High Point is a town of about 100,000 next to Greensboro. And it had, when we started working there, five neighborhoods that were open sore drug zones. And these places feel the same no matter where you go. They're small, they're tight, they're very often just a couple of blocks. And the housing stock changes from city to city, but that's really all that changes. Drug markets are drug markets are drug markets. And the cops were absolutely convinced that there were hundreds of people selling drugs in these areas because that's what it felt like to them. And when we really burrowed deep and did our homework and spent real time and figured it out, in the worst one in the city, there were 16 drug dealers.
Yeah, an amazingly small number of people who were really terrorizing the community in some ways.
Right. And they were tearing the place apart, they and all the dynamics that they set in train. But there just weren't that many of them. And they were not supporting their families. They were not using drug money to buy baby formula. So the this idea that everybody's involved and everybody's profiting and that's why people don't say anything is just flat wrong. And that's true, again, everywhere. So it turns out is the idea that they're scared and that's why they don't call the police. They're not scared. What they are is angry. And again, we've touched on this, but these are overwhelmingly already distressed African-American neighborhoods. Their historical and much of their current experience with the police has been absolutely toxic. The civil rights revolution in this country only goes back to 1968, and before that, the police were a formal, legitimate arm of oppression against Black Americans. The change in the formal civil rights regime is the same moment when we declared war on drugs and started arresting all the Black men. These are neighborhoods where people get stopped, their doors get kicked in, people feel like the police can't tell the difference between the 16 and everybody else, and a lot of the time they can't. They feel oppressed and intruded upon, and they don't like it.
The fabric of trust is just completely broken apart in these places.
What most of us read as either profiteering or fear is actually a deep, simmering outrage.
All right. Let's go back to those 16 drug dealers for a second. Are those people who are doing something that is crazy, which is dealing drugs, clearly illegal? Or are those people acting in a more logical way than you might think?
They're acting in a more logical way than you might think. And that's true in a variety of ways. The one that we all focus the most on is, are they going to get caught? And the answer over time is absolutely yes. They will probably get caught repeatedly. What we need to do is look at that from their point of view. And their point of view is that nearly all the time they get away with it. So there's good academic research on the prison risk for selling cocaine. So for every time you sell dope, how often do you get caught and then prosecuted and then sentenced and then actually go away? And the answer is almost unbelievable unless you're out there, in which case it's not surprising at all. But the risk is actually 1 in 15,000 sales. So 14,999 times you sell, you don't go to prison. And the hell of it is that the one time you're going to get caught, you don't know until it's too late, right? You find out when you're cuffed and in the patrol car, which means that the deterrence value of that is nearly zero. And what you want to do is create a regime so that when the guy goes out to the corner, he knows he's going to get shopped. And we figured out a way to do that, which very much surprised everybody.
Okay, so you met with the majority of these 16 drug dealers. They came to a meeting, a lot of them with their moms and grandmas. First of all, how'd you convince them to come to a meeting, a bunch of drug dealers? And the second is, how'd you convince them to stop dealing drugs?
The chief of police wrote them a letter and said, please come to a meeting, you won't be arrested. And then teams of police officers and residents visited each of these guys in person, talked to him, talked to his mother or grandmother or parent, delivered the letter, reinforced what it said, and we sat back and waited. And nearly all of them walked in the door of the police station, often accompanied by somebody like their mother, their grandmother, or their minister. But they came in voluntarily.
And what ended up then happening to the drug market in High Point in North Carolina? I mean, you couldn't possibly have gotten rid of the problem of drug addiction. So what happens?
What happened was there had been months and months of work before that letter went out. And what these guys didn't know was that High Point Police Department had gone through that drug market with a fine-tooth comb. They had researched it. They had researched it from their own records. They'd had undercovers out. They had confidential informants out. And over the course of that investigation, they had found and developed a prosecutable drug case against every single one of those dealers. And when they came into the meeting, they heard three things. They heard people in their own neighborhood say to them, "We care about you, but as one of my minister friends who was there says, we are against what you are doing. We are for you, but what you are doing is tearing this place apart, and we need you to stop it." And because of this anger against the police and the outside that we've talked about, it turns out that for a lot of drug dealers, it's the first time they've ever heard that. And that community sentiment, that public norm, is enormously powerful. So they heard people they respected say, "You need to stop this." They heard people say to them, "We would like to help you, and we have all kinds of programs and services for you. So here's the number you call. We will meet you where you are, and we will turn ourselves inside out for you." And they heard the chief of police say, "I could arrest you as you sit here. Here is the case file that we have put together. It has in it an unsigned warrant." In other such meetings, we've actually shown them the undercover videotape of their crack sales. We've had DAs say, "Gentlemen, when you see yourself committing a felony, please raise your hand." And everybody raises their hand. But what the chief of police then says is, "I'm not going to arrest you. What I am going to do is hang this case over your head. And the moment you go back to doing business, you go back to the corner, you start working the house again, all I need to do is sign this warrant. No new investigations, no new evidence, no new nothing. You go back at it, and we will pick you up within the hour." And what this does is it solves the 1 in 15,000 problem. It puts these guys on prior notice that if they keep it up, they absolutely will go to jail. And it turns out that put in that position, nearly none of them keep going.
And are drug dealers, do they just sort of sit there flabbergasted that force could be the answer? I mean, they could be handcuffed and taken away right then, but instead somebody's sitting them down, talking to them and saying, "You're making our community something that we're not happy with, and we want it to stop."
It's very interesting. The thing that makes the most difference is having the community people and the ministers and the elders on the block and their parents looking at them and disapproving. It is fantastically powerful. And, you know, I teach about this, and there's a lot of scholarship that says what academics call formal social control, so the state, the cops, the police, the courts, is much weaker than what theory calls informal social control, you know, your conscience, your neighbors, your mother, your community. And nobody believes this, right? If you talk to people about serious crime, nobody believes that soft is actually more powerful than hard. Right. And what I've learned to do, I will stand in a room full of, you know, seasoned narcotics people and say, "Would you raise your hand, please, if you grew up and you were really afraid of the cops?" And in a room full of 100 police officers, maybe 4 or 5 will raise their hand. And then I'll say to them, "Okay, good. When you were growing up, who was afraid of your mother?" And everybody raises their hand. And the fact is, both in real life and in theory, mom today trumps the feds 18 months from now. It's just how it works. And that is why, before we had this meeting, the chief of police in High Point went to this neighborhood and said to them, "I am sorry for the way we have been policing you. It has not worked. It has done all kinds of unintended damage. I understand that you feel abused. I understand why you feel abused. I think you are right to feel abused. And I am going to stop this. We are going to do this in a different way. But if we're going to do this differently, I need something from you. And what I need is for you to tell the guys that we are going to identify as causing the problem here that you need them to stop." And the community said, "When?"
I want to ask you about something that we've sort of seen locally here in the Boston area. You say in the book, this is a quote, there are out-of-control drug markets all over the country, and they're spreading. When I started, it was all core urban stuff, but not anymore. It's been moving into the small towns for years. I talked to local policeman Phil Tavares about the effect of prescription drug and heroin addiction on this area, but also on the nation as a whole. And he said part of it, of course, is that heroin has plummeted in price, and it's now running about $3 to $5 a dose.
It's much stronger than it used to be.
Exactly. And here is a little bit of my conversation with him and his sort of discussion of how hard it is as a policeman to deal with this.
Our task force has seen a dramatic increase in the amount of opiate addiction, and all the crimes that are related to that. The quality of life issues have just deteriorated. It's at epidemic proportions at this point.
And has it really sort of taken a toll, not just on the people who are using the drugs, but on the towns as a whole?
It has. Opiates are destroying our families and killing our residents throughout the region at alarming rates.
Why has heroin gotten so much cheaper? What's going on here?
I think what it is that in the suburbs, a lot of the people, the addicts, got first addicted to OxyContin or oxycodone, and then they could no longer afford their habit, and they switched to heroin, which is much cheaper. Historically, it's been cheaper.
David Kennedy is the author of Don't Shoot One Man, A Street Fellowship and the End of Violence in Inner City America, and we're talking about rethinking crime. David Kennedy, let me go to what policeman Phil Tavares said there. Are we seeing drug markets splinter so that they maybe left some of the inner cities, places where you've done your work, but they have ended up in the suburbs?
No, not really. So when I say the markets are spreading, what I'm talking about is these open sore public overt markets. And I see the same thing that Phil was talking about. Everywhere I go. So people in the suburbs will see an outbreak of the kind of thing he's talking about, and it is tragic. I have to be very careful about the way I talk about this. It's awful, but it is still the case that none of those suburbs are going to end up being places where all the white kids go to prison for the rest of their lives, where their streets are occupied by police officers stopping everybody and kicking their doors in. And where people are afraid to go outside. They are not going to become those places. And that is because no matter how severe the immediate impact of heroin and prescription drug use is, it does not lead and won't lead to this broad community collapse.
So for the small number of people who've been dealing drugs, can those people transition to a different life?
Not that many of them walk the bridge to middle-class life. But in order to change these conditions that we're talking about, they don't have to. They simply have to put their guns down. Mm-hmm. And if they're going to do crime, they need to do crime quietly and privately. And this, what I've just said, offends people enormously a lot of the time. And I will say that there are lots of communities in this great country of ours where there are groups of young men doing bad things and running in packs and breaking the law and behaving badly, including buying and selling and using an awful lot of drugs. But they're doing it quietly. They're doing it privately. They're doing it face-to-face. And the people who live in those communities are not getting killed, and they're not afraid to go outside. And the name for those great American communities is the suburbs. You know, there's dope in the suburbs, there's bad behavior in the suburbs, there's crime in the suburbs, but it is not tearing the community apart the way this public violence is in my neighborhoods. Yeah. And we just need to stop that.
One final question for you. Every time there is an outbreak of violence, let's say in Aurora, Colorado, you know, what that kind of mass shooting, a Columbine, there's a big debate, and it tends to flare out pretty quickly, about guns on the streets. I mean, you're in New York, and Mayor Michael Bloomberg has been very adamant about getting guns off the street, stricter gun laws. Mayor Tom Menino in Boston has felt the same way. What's your feeling?
My feeling is that I wish there was the kind of public attention to the routine violence that there is to the exceptional violence. So what happened in Colorado was appalling and one awful way of looking at it is that for a moment white folks felt a taste of the vulnerability that many inner city residents live with every single day. And the problem with homicide in the country is not people shooting up movie theaters. You know, when it happens, it is unspeakable. But that's not what's getting people killed. What's getting people killed day in and day out is this routine, numbing street violence in a very few, very distinct, almost entirely minority neighborhoods, and we pay essentially no attention to it.
Well, you say in the book that it's a, if you put together the homicides, it's a 9/11 every year, but we don't see it.
It's just young black men is a 9/11 every year. Right. That's correct.
David Kennedy, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Kennedy is the author of Don't Shoot, One Man, a Street Fellowship, and the End of Violence in Inner City America. He also directs the Center for Crime Prevention and Control at John Jay College of Criminal Justice in New York. When we return, the second part of our conversation with former Clinton advisor Bill Galston and former Bush advisor Mark McKinnon as they think about how to reinvent our political system. Remember that you can listen to our show anytime, anywhere by subscribing to our free podcast at wgbh.org/innovationhub. And you can join me and Innovation Hub live along with some of our favorite guests. That's on September 27th at the Modern Theater in Boston. We'll be talking about a force that is radically changing our economy, automation and robotics. What if the anemic recovery that we've seen goes beyond politics or chance or fiscal policy? What if, from CVS checkout lines to high-powered law offices, automation is increasingly replacing people? But there may be an upside, too. Here's one of our panelists, Daniel Theobald, talking about a robot who can help patients at the end of a long chemotherapy treatment.
We can use QCBot to deliver the medications straight to the patient in the transfusion chair. The patient can receive the medications from the QCBot, and then if they do have questions right up on the screen, the pharmacist can pop up, video teleconference, hey, I've got some questions about my medication, I was having these side effects, and the pharmacist can talk through that. And that way, when they're done with their transfusion, they can leave the hospital. They don't have to now go and wait in a line to get their medications.
Join us for that engaging evening on September 27th. You can find out more, including how to buy tickets at wgbh.org/innovationhub. I'm Kara Miller, and this is Innovation Hub.
Take this message.